Welcome. This is the New England Journal of Medicine. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. In this episode, we explore new treatments for hypertension, hereditary amyloidosis, and malaria prevention, along with insights on mosquito-borne disease control. We review idiopathic intracranial hypertension, follow a striking case of a hidden foreign body, and hear perspectives on worker safety, immigrant health care, the role of pharmaceutical wholesalers, and the arc of a medical career. Efficacy and safety of baxdrostat in uncontrolled and resistant hypertension by John Flack from Southern Illinois University, Springfield, and co-authors. Aldosterone dysregulation plays an important pathogenic role in hard-to-control hypertension. In several studies, baxdrostat, a nonsteroidal aldosterone synthase inhibitor, reduced the seated systolic blood pressure of patients with uncontrolled or resistant hypertension. This Phase 3 trial included patients with a seated systolic blood pressure of between 140 millimeters mercury and less than 170 millimeters mercury, despite the receipt of stable treatment with two antihypertensive medications, uncontrolled hypertension, or three or more such medications, resistant hypertension, including a diuretic. After a two-week placebo run-in period, 794 patients with a seated systolic blood pressure of 135 millimeters mercury or more were randomly assigned to receive baxdrostat at a dose of 1 milligram or 2 milligrams, or placebo, once daily for 12 weeks. Among these patients, the addition of baxdrostat to background therapy resulted in a significantly lower seated systolic blood pressure at 12 weeks than placebo. A potassium level of more than 6 millimoles per liter was reported in 2.3% of patients with 1 milligram baxdrostat, in 3% of patients with 2 milligrams baxdrostat, and in 0.4% of patients with placebo. In an editorial, Tomasz Guzik from the University of Edinburgh and Maciej Tomaszewski from the University of Manchester, both in the United Kingdom, write that the trial by Flack and co-authors showed clear efficacy of baxdrostat when added to standard therapy, as well as a manageable safety profile and mechanistic plausibility within sodium-driven hard-to-control hypertension. The next steps will include defining which patients are likely to have the best response with precision therapy, clarifying the use of aldosterone synthase inhibitors as compared with mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, standardizing early monitoring, and providing long-term data on durability and event reduction. Success would shift aldosterone synthase inhibition from a promising adjunct to a central pillar of therapy for difficult-to-control hypertension, thereby reinforcing a broader renaissance of natriuretic strategies in blood pressure control. Nexiguran ziclumeran gene editing in hereditary ATTR with polyneuropathy by Julian Gilmore from the Royal Free Hospital, London, and co-authors. Hereditary transthyretin amyloidosis, ATTR, with polyneuropathy is a rare, multisystem, progressive, debilitating, and fatal disease characterized by tissue deposition of misfolded transthyretin, TTR, in peripheral nerves. Nexiguran ziclumeran, Nex-Z, is an investigational in vivo therapy based on CRISPR-Cas9 and is designed to reduce serum TTR levels through selective inactivation of TTR in the liver. In this Phase 1 study, investigators administered a single infusion of Nex-Z to 36 patients with hereditary ATTR with polyneuropathy. Primary objectives included assessment of the safety and pharmacodynamics of Nex-Z. A single administration of Nex-Z in these patients was associated with rapid and durable reductions in serum TTR levels, with a mean reduction of at least 90% from baseline that was sustained from day 28 through month 36. Infusion-related reactions were the most common treatment-related adverse events in 58% of the patients. These events were of grade 1 or 2 in severity and rapidly resolved. The results support further investigation of Nex-Z to treat hereditary ATTR with polyneuropathy. Randomized trial of targeted indoor spraying to prevent Aedes-borne diseases by Natalie Dean from Emory University, Atlanta, and co-authors. Targeted indoor residual spraying focuses insecticide applications on common resting surfaces of Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, an arboviral disease vector, in houses, such as exposed lower sections of walls and under furniture. This trial in Merida, Mexico, sought to quantify the efficacy of targeted indoor residual spraying for preventing Aedes-borne diseases, chikungunya, dengue, or Zika. 4,461 children 2 to 15 years of age were enrolled from households in 50 clusters of 5x5 city blocks. Households in 25 clusters received an annual application of targeted indoor residual spraying before each season of Aedes-borne disease, July through December. All clusters received routine Ministry of Health vector control. The children were followed for 3 seasons. In this trial, annual treatment of households with targeted indoor residual spraying before the season of transmission of Aedes-borne viruses led to lower household density of A. aegypti mosquitoes than the control method. However, the targeted indoor residual spraying did not result in a significantly lower hazard rate of Aedes-borne disease among children. Permethrin-treated baby wraps for the prevention of malaria by Ross Boyce from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-authors. Malaria remains a major cause of childhood death in sub-Saharan Africa. In this trial conducted in Uganda, these investigators leveraged the traditional practice of mothers carrying children on their backs in cloth wraps to assess whether treating the wraps with an insect repellent might provide a layer of protection against malaria. 400 adult women with a child who was 6 to 18 months of age were randomly assigned to use permethrin-treated wraps or sham-treated wraps. The wraps underwent retreatment every 4 weeks. All the participants received a new pyrethroid-only long-lasting insecticide-treated bed net. Biweekly clinic attendance was high. Among these mother-child pairs who had access to bed nets, maternal use of permethrin-treated baby wraps significantly reduced the incidence of clinical malaria in the children. Idiopathic intracranial hypertension, a review article by Jonathan Horton from the University of California, San Francisco. Idiopathic intracranial hypertension, also called pseudotumor cerebri, refers to elevated cerebrospinal fluid, CSF pressure, that develops most often in women of reproductive age with obesity. The most common initial symptom is headache. Other prominent symptoms are neck pain, pulsatile tinnitus, and visual symptoms. Fundoscopic examination is critical to identifying papilledema, which is present in 95% of affected patients. MRI study rules out hydrocephalus or tumor and reveals characteristic findings that include a partially empty cella, distended optic nerve sheaths, protrusion of the optic discs into the vitreous cavity, and stenosis of the distal transverse dural sinuses. Lumbar puncture shows a high opening pressure and normal CSF, but ambiguous readings can occur because of overlap in the range of pressures recorded in patients with idiopathic intracranial hypertension and in unaffected persons. Nearly all patients can be treated medically with acetazolamide, which reduces CSF production, and with glucagon-like peptide 1 or gastric inhibitory polypeptide agonists to induce weight loss. Prompt surgical intervention is necessary if papilledema threatens vision. CSF shunting has been the standard surgical treatment. However, dural venous sinus stenting, which breaks the positive feedback cycle driving high intracranial pressure, appears to be gaining wider acceptance. A 36-year-old man with abdominal pain, fever, and hypoxemia. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Gurpreet Dhaliwal and colleagues. The following case presentation was provided to both Dr. Gurpreet Dhaliwal, master clinician and expert in clinical reasoning, and Dr. Cabot, an artificial intelligence AI system. Whether AI has a legitimate use in clinical decision-making is up to the reader to determine. Read the case and watch the videos at nejm.org. A 36-year-old man with a history of alcohol use disorder was admitted because of abdominal pain, fever, hypoxemia, and thrombocytopenia. He presented with 2 weeks of progressive abdominal and back pain, followed by fever, dyspnea, hypoxemia, thrombocytopenia, and jaundice. On arrival, he was febrile, tachycardic, and hypoxemic, with right upper abdominal tenderness and scleral icterus. Laboratory testing showed thrombocytopenia, elevated bilirubin, and cholestatic liver enzyme abnormalities. Imaging revealed bilateral pulmonary opacities, hepatomegaly with periportal edema, thickened duodenal wall, and a thrombus extending from the right renal vein into the inferior vena cava. Blood cultures grew streptococcus aginosus. MRI confirmed duodenal inflammation with a tract toward the right kidney, raising concern for perforation. On hospital day 3, CT angiography identified a linear, hyperdense foreign body penetrating the duodenum into the kidney. Endoscopy extracted a 5.2-centimeter wooden toothpick. Occupational health and safety on the chopping block. What's at stake? A perspective by Andrew Gabrielson from the Anne and Robert Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago and Claudia Corwin from the University of Iowa College of Medicine, Iowa City. In an era of labor shortages and rising workplace injury costs, the U.S. government has taken steps to dismantle the Bedrock Research Agency charged with safeguarding worker health, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH. In April 2025, the Department of Government Efficiency and the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, eliminated more than 80% of NIOSH staff as part of broader cuts affecting nearly 10% of HHS personnel. Although a court order has led to some NIOSH staff being reinstated, at least temporarily, various agency programs have been frozen and laboratories have closed. This disruption undermines decades of progress in worker safety, and it comes as the U.S. workforce is aging, climate-related disasters are increasing in frequency and severity, and new occupational hazards continue to emerge. NIOSH, a subsidiary of the CDC, plays a central role in supporting occupational safety by conducting the research that underpins workplace safety regulations and best practices. Its purview includes many high-risk industries, including healthcare, construction, agriculture, firefighting, and mining. The agency certifies personal protective equipment, conducts epidemiologic studies of occupational disease outbreaks, and monitors chemical, biologic, and heat exposures. The dismantling of NIOSH is expected to have far-reaching consequences, including an increase in preventable work-related injuries, illnesses, hazardous exposures, and deaths. Emergency Medicaid at risk. Preserving State Authority and Access to Care, a perspective by Joshua Budu from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, New York, and co-authors. Emergency Medicaid is a joint federal-state program that covers emergency medical services for people who would otherwise qualify for Medicaid but are ineligible because of their immigration status. This population includes most authorized immigrants within their first 5 years of U.S. residence, as well as unauthorized immigrants who meet income requirements. In May 2025, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a letter to states that signals an important change in practice. States that use federal dollars to provide health care to unauthorized immigrants beyond narrowly defined emergency services will face audits, enforcement actions, and potential recoupment of funds. Although the letter technically reiterates current law defining the scope of the emergency Medicaid program, it marks a departure from decades of practice. States have traditionally exercised substantial discretion in determining what services are covered under the program. The new guidance indicates that the current administration intends to break from precedent and limit state discretion, which states have used to meet the specific health care needs of their immigrant populations. As a result, many immigrants may be unable to access necessary care. But emergency Medicaid is a vital component of the healthcare safety net. Preserving state flexibility in emergency Medicaid isn't just fiscally responsible, it is a public health imperative. Pharmaceutical wholesalers, under the radar middlemen? A perspective by Hayden Rook Lay from Brown University School of Public Health, Providence, Rhode Island, and Rachel Sachs from Washington University in St. Louis. In recent years, lawmakers and regulators have grown alarmed about vertical integration and the role of middlemen in the U.S. healthcare system. Yet, pharmaceutical wholesalers, a different set of middlemen, have largely evaded public scrutiny. Pharmaceutical wholesalers operate on the acquisition side, purchasing pharmaceuticals from manufacturers and selling and distributing them to pharmacies, hospitals, and medical practices. Wholesalers compete to distribute drugs to pharmacies and medical practices, at least under the traditional business model, in which independent practices have an incentive to shop for lower-priced drugs. This market has become increasingly concentrated and transformed by vertical integration. Just three wholesalers, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and Cencora, control 98% of the wholesaler market. In recent years, wholesalers have engaged in multi-billion dollar acquisitions of medical practices, which they control by means of corporate entities known as Management Services Organizations, MSOs. McKesson initiated this trend in 2010 by acquiring U.S. Oncology, an MSO that is now the largest oncology practice network in the United States. And McKesson now has a controlling stake in what was the largest remaining oncology practice in 2024. The other two wholesalers have made similar moves. Now these companies are expanding into non-cancer specialties. Integration led by drug wholesalers is likely to continue in specialties in which high-cost drugs are prescribed. These acquisitions may raise costs and undermine clinical autonomy. You still going to be doing this? A perspective by Eric Shapiro from Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, Cleveland. You still going to be doing this? Initially, this question, or some variant of it, was asked by a few patients with an almost embarrassed curiosity after a procedure. In gastroenterology, Dr. Shapiro's specialty, standard practice often involves extended intervals between procedures, generally ranging from 3 years for screening in high-risk patients to 10 years for those with average risk. His patients knew it would be a while before they needed to see him again. Over the next few years, as Dr. Shapiro entered his 60s, the tone of the questions evolved. They became more direct and matter-of-fact. Dr. Shapiro supposed the rapid calculation patients made based on his past middle-aged appearance to arrive at the possibility that he wouldn't still be practicing when their next visit occurred must have seemed obvious to them. It just hadn't to him. At first, he was startled. He'd never seriously considered the timeline of his own career. But a few decades rolled by, and now the children of his long-standing patients come to see him. Eventually, he realizes the time has come to try to figure out the answer to, "Are you still going to be doing this?" But the decision doesn't come easily. On a day-to-day basis, Dr. Shapiro loves what he does, mostly because of the connections with those patients and the nurses, techs, secretaries, medical assistants, and his partners. Also because medicine always changes and always fascinates. Now, when the question about his plans for the future arises, almost inevitably, after the discussion of follow-up intervals, Dr. Shapiro smiles and replies that it's more than likely he will have moved along. In our images in clinical medicine, butterfly vertebra is shown. In a 21-year-old woman who presented with a 7-day history of sore throat and cough, a chest X-ray showed 2 hemivertebrae at the 9th thoracic vertebral body. Oral verrucoform xanthomas are shown in another image. A 22-year-old woman presented with a 3-month history of bumps on the right ventral surface of her tongue. On physical examination, the bumps were observed to be pink papillomatous lesions measuring 3 to 8 millimeters in diameter. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.